good morning. It's 10:09 on the money. Mike McConnell, got a Wednesday. Who is this? Daft Punk, really? The newest album from Daft Punk. Well, let's hear it all. We haven't done an album feature on this program in a long time. It's been forever. All right, tonight's the night. I actually find myself getting nervous. I'm getting nervous. It's like I play for them or something. What? Come on. Get over it. I'm a spectator. I don't even have tickets. I'm not even going. And I still feel somewhat nervous over this. I don't know why. It's because it's such a fast game. That kind of hit me. Game 7 of the game with the Red Wings. And you go into overtime. And it's the fastest game in the world, let's face it. And you realize, you know, this could go in either direction in the next 15 seconds. And that's what I love about hockey, you know, especially when it gets to something like a game 7 or a championship game or an overtime game, and because things can go in either direction so quickly. And I just know something like that's going to happen, and it's making me nervous. So what do we have? In order to celebrate, we have a couple of things going on. First, we're going to have you dressed in the finest of gear. You got to like our WGN radio page and enter the Toyota Blackhawks jersey contest. You could win a brand new sweater to showcase your team pride. And I'll announce a winner tomorrow and another one on Friday. You have plenty of chances to win. It's sponsored by Chicagoland Toyota Dealers. Toyota, let's go places. So get on there and like us. And there you are. It could be yours. Other fun and games, stuff we'll give away later on. Guest here at the bottom of the hour. It's pretty interesting. It's kind of ties into that Chad Johnson thing we touched on yesterday, to where we have a difficult time. A joke is funnier depending on the, you know, where it's told. A joke in an inappropriate moment is that much funnier than it would be at other times. And this guy's whole point is that we have to be able to, you know, take a joke to a degree, to some extent. And I kind of came down on Mr. Johnson's side yesterday, but being the open-minded individual that I am, I've kind of changed my mind on that. In fact, my kid is in a similar line of work, and I emailed and asked what she thought of it, his behavior in court. And she's in there pretty much every day. Said, I've seen his behavior in court. I'm not surprised at all the judge didn't find it humorous. It's one of those where he was given a chance to make it all go away if he sucked it up, followed the rules, and didn't get in any trouble while on probation. Instead, he failed to ever meet with his probation officer, which is what put him back in front of the judge a second time. At that point, rather than act like he knew he screwed up and ask for a second chance, he goofed around and grabbed his lawyer's butt. If someone isn't acting like they understand the severity of what they did, probation doesn't seem like a very good option. How'd she get so tough? What the? Aside from that, I think holding him in contempt for his disrespect to the proceeding and an officer of the court would have been another option, but that would technically require another hearing, so it's just as easy to send him on the underlying charge. The judge made some comment that it wasn't the first time he behaved that way in her courtroom, and I believe it. When he had cases here, he'd spend his time writing love notes on napkins and giving them to court employees. He treated the whole thing like a joke. Had it been the first stupid thing he'd done in a courtroom, admonishment would have probably been enough. I have no problem with him being sent away. Ah, tough as nails.
She even writes to you in court speak.
Kids these days, lighten up. Come on. She usually has a sense of humor about her, but strictly business on that one. So, yeah, if he's always that way, then at some point the 30 days might give him some time to think about it.
See, my thing is, because, you know, it comes down to where it sounds like we're defending or I'm defending a domestic abuser, but the judge had decided that the plea deal was significant or was sufficient.
Acceptable.
Yeah. So that's what kind of bothers me. If she had decided it was sufficient, then to turn on a dime like that just was bizarre.
Yeah, and it's because everybody else laughed, not so much because of what he did.
Right.
But the jokey thing we'll get to at the bottom of the hour, about 10:35, as a matter of fact. Yesterday, we had that guest on late in the program on 3D printing, and we went over there after the show yesterday, and I got a little head bust of myself made. It is very cool what they can do with 3D printers. It was, it's not just that. A lot of, you know, serious work can be done. An obvious example, some of the examples they had, say you're an architect and you've designed some buildings around a plaza, whatever the case may be, something that would have cost you thousands of dollars to strike a model of in the past, you can simply do for a minor number of dollars by having the whole thing 3D printed. And you just put the information, the parameters into the computer, and it prints out a model. And it was very cool. They had, what was that, a titanium chainmail glove.
And how you can print something, like, I don't know, I didn't see that done, but, you know, I put it on. We shot some video. Eventually we'll get it all edited down, and you'll get a better idea of what it's about, but I do have my little head now. It's probably about 3 inches tall, maybe. And unfortunately, I had a fright wig hair day going on, so my bust came out with a bit of a fright wig hair. But we'll get it posted. It's right on Clark Street, just on the north side of the river. So right smack dab in the middle of downtown if you work there, and it's worth checking out. Elsewhere, what do we have? What do we have? Odds and ends from around the world. I've said before that whenever the you do surveys, sex surveys on, you know, men and women, I think men tend to exaggerate perhaps their sexual past, and women tend to minimize their sexual past. And somebody finally did a study that proves just that. What did they do? This is Ohio State University. A study there showed that first they had people sit down and fill out a questionnaire asking about their sexual history. Then they took them into another room and hooked them up to what the same people thought was a polygraph, a lie detector, and asked them the same questions again. And when they asked them the questions again, the men's numbers of experiences tended to come down and the women's numbers of experiences tended to go up, even though it wasn't a real polygraph. They simply thought it was. So proof comes out that they do lie on sex surveys. And probably no one lies more than teenage boys. You know, somehow they've all been lucky by age 16, and none of the girls have. So something's going on. There was an appeal for the kid, a 7-year-old, and he was eating a Pop-Tart at school, and they felt that he ate it into the shape of a gun, so he got himself suspended for that. So now, why the parents bothered to appeal this, I don't know. It's not like it's going to be on his criminal record forever. He's 7, but they appealed, and they got an attorney. And the attorney for the second grader went to the school to have it expunged. Robin Ficker, attorney for the Park Elementary School student Josh Walsh and his family, lost his appeal. He was denied. He will now appeal to the school board. How much are you spending on this? He was suspended back in March for 2 days after school officials accused him of shaping the Pop-Tart into the form of a gun and waving it around. Last month, the attorney met with school officials in an attempt to have the suspension expunged. No resolution was reached. So on to the superintendent. They said Monday he received a letter from a school official acting as the superintendent's designee who said the appeal request was denied. He has 30 days to appeal to the county school board. Will likely do so this week. And how much is tied up in this over a 2-day suspension on the 7-year-old? I have no idea, although it was a ridiculous suspension in the first place. Most of us could agree. Here's a Don't Tell Rom, a way to raise money. In the U.K., airports are now charging people to drop someone off at the terminal. You can't actually go to the terminal. They send you into this short-term drop-off area and charge you to get in. People call it the kiss and drop. Bye, honey. They are now charging to drop somebody off at the airport. And they list the different fees here. One of them, London City Airport, it's £5.50 in pounds, and that's probably about $9. $9 to drop someone off at the airport. Other areas, it's £2, so it's £3 or £3.50. Seems to be more average. But they're always, you know, shaking the tree, looking for other dollars to fall from somewhere. And the kiss and drop might be next. Don't tell Rom. And the study has been done. It shows that the kids under the age of 7 have killed more Americans so far this year than terrorism. I have details ahead. It is 10:17. Mike McConnell go until noon. Then the noon show up until Cubs pregame. All here, 720 WGN. Maestro, Thursday, 9 o'clock. What's this little ditty? More Daft Punk? Really? Becoming a fan. Feeling funkified. First thing in the morning, funkified. So the stats don't lie. More kids, more toddlers have killed adults so far this year than terrorism has. 11 deaths in 5 months where the shooter was between 3 and 6 years old. And our only terror attack so far this year was the bomb in Boston. That claimed 4 lives. So terrorism, 4. Toddlers, 11. And then it lists them. In some cases, unfortunately, somebody, you know, a little kid killed his friend. In some cases, a little kid kills his father. Little kid finds a pink gun and thinks it's a toy in Greenville and kill somebody. 11-4 is the tally as of now. If you're a gun owner, you take care of your guns. You put them away, you lock them up properly. And what's my story here? Ladies tried to smuggle money into Canada, stuffed in bras. It's a mother-daughter combo. Canadian mother, teenage daughter, found to have nearly $60,000 stuffed in their bras after they were stopped and searched on Sunday afternoon as they tried to cross the U.S. at the Detroit crossing. The name's kind of tough to say. Maura El Esmar and her daughter, Jacinta, were passengers in a car driven by a fellow Canadian. She told border agents she and her child were being driven to the Detroit airport, where they were booked on a flight to Lebanon, where they planned to visit relatives in about 10 weeks, as they were taking this money abroad, apparently. So they searched her purse and found $15,000 in Canadian currency, $300 in U.S. money, which she failed to declare as required by law. Now, I understand this money laundering thing, but, I mean, is that the only reason you can't carry money out of the country? I think you have to declare, is it more than $10,000? I think the $10,000, you have to tell them that you're taking that money out of the country. And I guess it's all about money laundering. It seemed to me, if I wanted to take my money on vacation with me, and I had $25,000, come on, $25,000, let's go to Aruba. Why shouldn't I be able, you know, in a free country, to take my money on vacation? Well, bottom line is, you can't. So once they did a pat-down on the mom, her bra seemed kind of bulky, apparently. They said a bulky mass was discovered in the bra. And sure enough, Canadian cash, $39,000 in mom's bra. So during questioning, she acknowledged that she sewed some money into her teenage daughter's bra as well. They checked the girl's bra, $10,000 in Canadian currency. They said they concealed the money for safety. Only declared $3,300 at the border crossing because she didn't want her boyfriend to know she had so much money on her. So all told, $73,000 in U.S. currency. Well, when you take the Canadian and transfer it to American money, $73,000 trying to get it to Lebanon. Why can't you take your money on vacation? My money has never been to the Middle East. My money wants to see what things are like. And speaking of which, it's been a long time since I've bounced a check, but some people apparently bounce them quite often. What would you think is the average if you take all the bounced checks in America in a year and break it down per capita? What would it cost each of us in bounced check fees in a year? $225 a year. That's a lot of check bouncing. Especially since, you know, the Congress made the banks change the way they do business. It used to be, you know, you're low on funds, they would go ahead and put the biggest check in first to make it bounce, so all the smaller checks bounced behind it, and they set it up so they can't do that anymore. You have to take the checks in the order they come in and deduct it from the account. But no, it works out to $225 per year, says the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, and what they're protecting us from, I don't know. The highest fees charged these days for a bounced check is $35. So some people are doing it all the time. Now, when I was in college, I was known to, if I really needed a pizza from time to time, I may have bounced a check, but it's been a long time since I've done that. I try to keep it on the straight and narrow. And remember the big tornado that hit Moore, Oklahoma? And they said it was an E5? They're now doubting that it was an E5. In fact, they think for the most part it was an EF2 and an EF3. But the buildings were so poorly constructed that it looked like an E5 went through. They said if you're in a tornado area, you should at least build your houses to hurricane standards. Hurricane standards means that you use metal flashing to attach the roof to the side walls. And if the roof stays on, then the house usually stays intact. If the roof blows off, it's not. It doesn't. So the amount of damage that was done there was done because the homes were poorly engineered and poorly constructed. And I always say, you know, when a hurricane hits Florida and things get blown away, the governor should get on the radio and read the story of the three pigs to everybody. You know, sticks don't work so well. You want to go with something like brick. You know what I'm saying? Well, certainly in tornado areas, yeah, your roof should be better attached to the rest of the house and it wouldn't blow away. All right, joke time ahead. My guest has a book called The Joker, I think it is, The Joker. As he's one of those who admits he's one of those guys has a problem. He tells jokes at very inappropriate times, but they tend to be funnier when you do. We'll get to it. It's WGN. All right, subject of joking at an inappropriate time has been in the news a couple times recently, and came across this book, which I'm working my way through, but it's pretty funny. And it's kind of on that subject called The Joker. Andrew Hudgens, I think I have that right, is an English professor at Ohio State University, And it's his book, and it's brand spanking new, and it pretty much deals with that. I mean, the joke is funnier depending on the, you know, when it's told, and sometimes it's funniest at the most inappropriate times. But Andrew Hudgens, good to have you on the program. How are you?
Oh, I'm doing fine. Pleasure to talk to you.
You betcha. This is a problem that, well, it's not a problem. I was like this for a while, and I guess maybe my line of work got me out of it because it's, you know, potentially if your job's on the line, you tend to do less of that.
Yes.
But when I was, you know, when I was younger, I could, it was always funnier when you were supposed to be, you know, maintaining proper decorum or whatever the case might be. And your point is you've had this problem all your life too, correct?
Exactly. When I was a kid, I was always, well, not always, but I got a little bit older. And, you know, you could be a smart ass in class. And making that joke in class where the teacher could get down on you made it funnier than telling that joke to your friends
right
by yourself.
Right. And then, I mean, in your case, according to the book, this carried well into adulthood, and you're best known as a poet, correct?
Yes, that's what I do, but I actually, but I'm still one of those compulsive jokers and joke tellers that's always kind of in trouble.
Yeah, I mean, we don't usually put funny and poet together, so it's interesting.
Yeah. Well, poets have more of a sense of humor than you might think, but you don't get rewarded for it very much.
Well, that's it. You have a couple of instances in the book where you're at a reading or whatever with a number of well-known poets, and your jokes don't always go over. They go over with about half the people in the crowd. It's
exactly. You never know how an audience is going to react. And some people, particularly at a poetry reading, they expect it to be somber and serious, and they're offended when you violate that rule. On the other hand, there are those people who like to see that somberness overturned.
And but do you get the impression that we're losing our sense of humor? I mean, that fewer people get the joke or appreciate the joke or think we have a greater number of people who find it to be inappropriate?
You know, I've really struggled with understanding that issue, but we are a very sensitive people right now, and so even the mild teasing that Gordon Gee, my boss at Ohio State, did, it seems to have cost him his job.
Yeah, and I never did see the context of that until I read the piece you had in the Wall Street Journal. And everything he was saying in a joking fashion, correct? He had the comments about Notre Dame.
Yes.
And
the comments about the SEC, which, now that one sounded pretty bad. And a couple of my friends who are Alabama grads were a little upset about that. But what he'd said is if the SEC learned how to read, they would understand what we were doing. But that was in response to the question, what do you say to the people from the SEC who say, if the Big Ten has 14 schools, why can't you people count?
And his response was, well, tell the SEC when they learn how to read and write, they can figure out what we're doing.
Exactly.
Nothing wrong with that.
That seems to be perfectly mild teasing in tone with the question.
Sure. And then the one about Notre Dame, mm-hmm. Who was he speaking to at the time? He said the fathers are holy on Sunday, mm-hmm. and they're holy hell the rest of the week.
Exactly. Now, that you know, that's an old Catholic joke, and he was speaking to some athletic council or something like that, and I would guess, since we're in central Ohio, that a third to half that crowd were Catholics, and they knew he was teasing with them.
Right. But then it sits there and simmers for a couple of months and comes back and costs him his job.
Exactly.
I guess he's choosing to retire, but that's the easier way than to boot him out. And he was, up to that point, considered one of the finest college presidents in the country.
Time magazine named him the best a couple of years ago.
And in the book, you have a couple others, and I forgot that Earl Butz, was he?
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
what was his cabinet position back at the time?
Yeah, he was Secretary of Agriculture back during, I guess it was the Ford administration, and he started off with a pretty funny joke, and he was, John Dean of Watergate fame was covering the story for Rolling Stone,
mm-hmm.
and he was on the plane leaving the convention, and Butz and Pat Boone was there, and you could see that this earthy Secretary of Agriculture was loving getting under Pat Boone's skin.
Right, Pat Boone is pretty much considered squeaky clean.
Exactly.
So he's going to play off on that.
Exactly. And so he tells some story. He asks why, I think it was Bob Dole's speech or Gerald Ford's speech, wasn't very well received at the end of the convention. And Butts said, it's like the old joke about the dog. Can I say screwing?
I just did.
Okay. Having sex. Yeah. With the squirrel, sometimes it's a monkey, that's having sex with the skunk, rather. And he says that he could only take it so long. And I thought that was a pretty funny story just to get under Pat Boone's skin. But then he went ahead and told a famously racist joke that I know I can't tell.
Right. And but he, again, the purpose of the joke was because he was telling it to Pat Boone. That's
exactly.
I mean, he probably wouldn't have bothered to tell the joke to somebody else who was known to be a bit more, I don't know, someone who had some dirt under their fingernails.
Exactly. Exactly.
And that cost him his job.
And it cost him his job. And in that case, I've got to agree. He went with the, he told a racist, sexist joke that was, it's really mind-blowing.
You know, and there have been times, and that's the problem with this interview, is I can't retell the jokes, but there was, I was once at a party, and it was at, you know, a nice house, and it was I wouldn't say an upper-class gathering, but certainly it had that appeal to it. It was semi-formal, nice buffet laid out on the buffet in the formal dining room and whatnot, and I just happened to be putting a few hors d'oeuvres on a plate, and somebody behind me let loose with the most tasteless joke in that setting
Wow.
you could possibly believe. And I couldn't stop laughing, not because it was that funny, but because of where they told it.
Exactly.
You know, and in mixed company. I couldn't believe he said it. And, you know, it can't be repeated here, but it's always funnier when it's in that context.
Exactly. Exactly. And one of the points that I tried to make in that New York Times piece was, jokes depend on surprising us. And then the next step is shock. And if you get the shock just right, everybody laughs even more. But if you get the shock wrong, then you outrage people.
Right. And you even make the point that you've had people come up to you and after, you know, a class at the graduate level and say they thought that a joke was too tasteless, a joke you told in class.
Exactly, exactly.
Would that have happened 20 years ago?
Yes, I think it would have. It's people are a little more sensitive, but also people are willing to speak up more than I think they used to. It's really interesting because I remember one of the students did say to me that the students had clearly been talking about my jokes, and it took them a while to realize that I didn't mean anything by them. I was simply recounting them as jokes that illustrated certain points.
Yeah, you mentioned the refrain several times. Hey, it was just a joke. You know,
exactly.
When people don't get it. And, you know, people have told what they thought was a joke when I was there that I didn't think was funny either. And you can't please all the people all the time. I think the world would be a lot better off if we were less sensitive to these things than we are.
I agree, but, you know, and humor can go so wrong. I remember when I was a kid, I'd go to the library, and I'd get the cartoon books out from the old Saturday Evening Post or things like that, you know, those year annual cartoons in review.
Right.
And I learned pretty early that if you laughed at 10 to 15% of those cartoons, that was a really good percentage.
Yeah, you mentioned that in the book as well. Some of the jokes, little kids' jokes, I didn't think were very fun. The first joke you hear is like, you know, why did the chicken cross the road? What's black and white and red all over? They weren't funny then. They weren't funny when I was five, and they're not funny now.
I agree. But they start training our mind to see puns and things like that.
Right.
And because I remember being a kid puzzling over those like they were Zen Cohen, you know, trying to figure out what the heck they meant.
Well, that's what's funny about a pun. Sometimes it's so stupid you can't believe the guy had the nerve to say it. That makes
yes.
it funny.
Yep. You know, one of my favorites, where does George Washington keep his armies?
Where?
In his sleeveys.
See? It's stupid.
It's stupid. But I still giggle.
Yeah. Well, the one, as far as telling a joke at an inappropriate time, the one that involved Hitler in 1944. You tell it.
Yeah, Fritz Dargis was in the Wolf's Lair with Hitler, and they were looking at a map, and Dargis was the army adjutant, and this fly was flying around, landing on the map, landing on Hitler's shoulder, landing on the map again, and it was irritating Hitler, who turns to Dargis and says, "Take care of that." And without missing a beat, Dargis says, he points at the, I forget his name, but he was the Air Force adjutant, and he said, "It's an airborne pest. It's his job."
And he was sent to the front.
And Hitler screamed at him, "You're for the Eastern Front."
And off
he
went.
Immediately sent him out to the Eastern Front.
And I'd imagine others in that situation had a hard time not laughing.
I wondered what it would be like suppressing your laughter around Hitler.
Yeah, it'd be tough. Well, listen, I find myself out of time. I have to run, but the book, The Joker, we can get this at Amazon and wherever better books are sold, I'd imagine, right?
Absolutely.
All right, Andrew Hudgens, get back to work on your poetry. I appreciate your time.
I'm glad to talk to you. Thank you.
All right, have a good day. You bet. Right back, WGN. Yeah, who's nervous? Who's nervous? I'm nervous. Just had some Bruins fans outside the window here, Allstate Showcase Studios, kind of flashing their little Bruins T-shirt, thinking they're cool. What do we have? What do we have? Anybody have a tramp stamp? Hey, intern Lisa, you have any tattoos? Tattoo? Okay, thank you very much. That's a good sign. Do we put that on the application? Do we deny interns a position here if they have tattoos? No. Well, the study is done on tramp stamps. Tramp stamps, which is the one that goes across your lower back, as you may know. Study done in France, it turns out that women who have that particular stamp on the beach get hit on more often than women who don't. And turns out to be, it says, it makes you look promiscuous. And I'll bet that's the last thing a woman thought of when she got that thing put on her lower back to begin with.
Really? I mean, it's called a tramp stamp.
Well, they don't know that.
They don't know that?
They don't know that. What would you call that? It has to be some, Kristen, a normal name for that tattoo. Nobody says, "I want a tramp stamp," would they? I've also heard ass antlers, but tramp stamp.
I've never heard that.
I've heard that one.
It seems to work.
Kristen mentioned butt hat. I don't know. But so if you're going to buy it, I mean, I don't know what you ask for, but the study was done. They say it's like advertising I'm easy. That's the implication. New research from France found men more likely to approach a woman lying on the beach if she had that tattoo. It says here a butterfly tattoo, they're calling it, on her lower back. The guys in the study didn't think the body art made her more attractive, but they believed it increased the likelihood of her being receptive to his advances. So now you know. You're advertising. The stereotype of promiscuousness associated with tattoos may or may not be accurate, they say, although it likely is. The study suggests many men believe it is so and then act accordingly. They did this on beaches in the south of France. They had 11 young women aged 20 or thereabouts who were judged as above average in attractiveness, and they made 20 trips to the beach. Wearing a two-piece suit, each woman read a book while lying flat on her stomach. A male associate discreetly watched from a nearby location. When she was approached, she told the stranger she was waiting for her boyfriend, and the associate would then show up to play that role. About half the time, the woman had a temporary butterfly tattoo on her back. On each visit, the associate noted how long it took before she was approached by a man, and they'd be out there for 1 hour at a time if she was left alone. They had significantly more men approach women when they exhibited a tattoo. In addition, contact was typically made earlier in the allotted hour.
I don't think it has anything to do with the tattoo. I think it has to do with the clothing that you have to wear in order to see the tramp stamp.
Well, they would go out without the tramp stamp and lay there and read the book and not be approached.
Christian.
Or it would take longer.
It's all about the tramp stamp.
It's all about the stamp.
Right.
Somebody called in and said it was scooter trash.
There's probably a list of those, probably, you know, dozens of them floating around out there. They're still kind of like ass antlers. But anyway, he sent 11 volunteers and their male associates back to the beach each time the men interviewed male beachgoers, pointing to the woman from a short distance away, asking them what they thought about her. Their opinion of her attractiveness was consistent, whether or not she had the tattoo, but men thought they were more likely to have a date, so to speak, if she had the tattoo. And believe it or not, a better chance of having sex with her on that first date, believe it or not. So if you're sporting one, I mean, we love you as a listener. Besides, I don't have to see it. But now you know. And maybe that was the idea to begin with. Who knows? We have news just a couple away. This is WGN. If our Bruins fans come to the window, we got to give them a talking to. I'd imagine some of the prices people were paying for tickets had to do with people in Boston buying tickets. We talked about the cost of tickets yesterday, which we'll revisit here in a bit. But as I shift gears, reading yesterday in the Tribune, the piece by Dennis Byrne, who's, you know, when you go on vacation, you know, you've looked forward to it in many cases for months, maybe a year, maybe more, depending where you're going, someplace you always wanted to go. And Mr. Byrne apparently was in Rome and didn't have such a great time. When crime hits you on vacation, it's one of the worst times you could possibly be affected by it, but I want to know more. So, Dennis Byrne, good to have you on the program. How you doing, sir?
I'm doing good. Nice to be here.
You betcha. So, you went to Rome. Have you been there more than once?
No, just there once. This was a few years ago, and the reason I wrote about it now is I figured, well, you know, some 8 years ago or something like that, I figured they'd get the problem with pickpockets in hand. It was so obvious. But then I started reading news stories about things like the Vatican tour guides were threatening to strike because pickpockets there were getting to be so omnipresent. If you look up at in the Sistine Chapel, you look up at Michelangelo's wonderful painting there.
Mm-hmm.
People were reporting that while they're looking up, their pocket would be picked. There's a lot to be complain about.
Yeah,
and
I looked it up yesterday, and Rome is the second most notorious city in the world for pickpocketing. Number one is Barcelona.
Yeah, that's what I've heard too. I've never been to Barcelona, and I guess I won't plan to go there. I don't know how these things can keep going on. I mean, the police and the authorities and these cities should know. It's so obvious. All you have to do is go to, like in Rome, the Trevi Fountain or the Spanish Steps or get on the metro, and you'll see it. It's going on. I got my pocket picked 2 hours after I got to Rome. It's amazing.
And you said you took all the proper precautions, correct?
I did. I really did. But you can't assume that the pickpockets aren't reading the same cautions that you're reading, and they have they're smart cookies. They know how to do it, and they'll get it done. Now you can stop them. There are ways to do it if you're really careful.
Yeah, I put my wallet in my underwear.
Well, that is one suggestion. I tell you, after the first day I was there, I got my pocket picked. The next day I was there, I got a money belt, put my money in, got on the metro again. At the same stop by the Spanish Steps, I felt my shirt being pulled up. It was, again, in a crowded subway car, and there's a guy, about 3 inches from my face, and I look down, and he's pulling my shirt up to get to my money belt. Well, I give him the evil eye, and he stops, and a minute later, I feel my shirt being pulled up again. I mean, these guys never stop.
Yeah, I was there once, and nobody with the group we were with had that problem. You know, beggars were the thing I saw all over the place. And they must make a killing because they, especially around the Vatican, people come out sort of feeling all full of the Lord, and they're, you know, handing these little old ladies euros, and I think they could make certainly in excess of $100 an hour standing out there begging.
Well, that's a problem, and the sidewalk vendors, and there's a lot of ways that they separate the tourists from their money, and that's to be expected. But the pickpocketing is something I would blame the Italian authorities for. It doesn't take a genius to figure out that your city is plagued with it, and that's why I wrote the column. Maybe somebody in Rome or the Italian consulate will get the idea that people don't want to go there because they're going to be victimized. After all, we're their guests. There's no way to treat a guest. Someone comes to your home for dinner, you don't pick their pocket.
I wouldn't be surprised if this wasn't reprinted in Italian by today or tomorrow, because it's, you know, with the web as it is, and the headline is "How to Avoid the Pickpockets in Rome, Don't Go."
Yeah.
On the other hand, here's my on the other hand.
Yeah.
My girlfriend's purse was pickpocketed in Chicago. and occasionally, you know, you'll read where a tourist somehow got robbed along Michigan Avenue or something, and it does happen. And when that happens, you know, as you did, they'll go back and tell everybody, God, don't go anywhere near Chicago.
Right, right. And in fact, I got some very negative reaction to the column from people saying exactly that point. You know, don't go on the L with your iPhone. You'll lose it and things like that. Or people who had gone to Rome and said, this was never a problem for me. What's wrong with you? You know, are you stupid? You just gave them away your wallet or something like that.
So in your case, how did they get it? You were on the train?
I was on the train. Me and my wife were actually coming back from the Spanish Steps, went down to the platform. Now, on the way into the train, I made the mistake of pulling out my wallet, and so you have to show a pass, at least back then you did, to whoever's standing at the gate, and it's very informal. Sometimes there's nobody standing there, so you just walk in, they kind of trust you. But in the lobby to the station up above the platform, I mean, there were people hanging out, just sitting around and keeping around. Well, they saw me, somebody there saw me pull out my wallet, and then went down and apparently followed me down. My wife, the train pulled in, my wife and I got on the train. I could see it was crowded, and I was motioning to my wife, let's get off, but I didn't want to leave her on the train, and me, and so I got on. Well, pretty soon I was being pressed from all sides. I mean, really, really pressed. So I wouldn't, as I said in the column, somebody with mittens could have picked my pocket because, and you know, they knew exactly where I put my wallet, which was in my pocket.
A side pocket, back pocket, where?
It's my front pocket,
right.
as the advice was. Kept my hand on it. Of course, now when I'm being pushed and the train starts up, the train lurches, and I grabbed for the support pole.
Right.
Well, as soon as I grabbed with the hand in my pocket, the other hand was pressed to my side. I assume they got it. A minute after I got off the train, I discovered it was gone. And the train was gone. The train was pulling out of the station. You know, away, bye, wallet. That's the end of that. And it's amazing. As soon as I got back to the hotel, I reported my wallet was stolen, and to the credit card companies. In that amount of time, they had already gone to some shop or store there and charged over $1,000 worth of merchandise on the credit card. The other credit card that I had lost at the time said, apparently looked at it and said, Dennis Byrne in Rome, that won't happen, and they refused to take the payment. So one credit card was really on the ball. The credit card, the company that had $1,000 charged on it, they didn't make me pay it. So that was very good.
What about getting new credit cards to continue your vacation? They kind of come in handy.
Oh, that was a pain. I had an American Express card, and I had to go wait 2 hours in the American Express office for issue a new card. It was like it was pretty bad service. I mean, I was left standing there for a long time.
Well, they probably got your ID, your driver's license, everything.
They did, and I was afraid that I'd get my identity stolen. But that was years ago. Like I said, they probably weren't as sophisticated about that. They just wanted the quick cash, and they got it.
Yeah. So the point is that you've read more about it, and it's gotten one, and I did too. It's gotten no better. Pickpockets are still, I mean, they exist here, but there are some places where people just make a living off that and that alone, and it seems like there's a lot of them. So,
well, it does, and as I said in the column, I think if Italy ever gets back into a banking crisis, they can always go to the pickpockets of Rome and say, "Oh, bankroll us for a little while."
Well, I think on the list of the top 10 cities that are worst for pickpocketing, I think 8 were in Europe. So it's bad almost anywhere you go over there, but Rome is second worst. So just quickly, how's your book on the War of 1812 doing?
Well, I think it's doing okay. It's out now since the last time we talked, and it's you can get it on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and the rest of it. It's just won an award for something called the New York Book Festival. Got honorable mention there for fiction. So I'm pleased with that. Got nice reviews from Rick Colgan and Zay Smith, so I think it's going okay.
What was the title again?
It's called Madness, The War of 1812, historical novel about the war. It I think it's probably the most bungled war we've ever fought. People will argue with that, but really, if you read the book, you'll see it really was atrocious handling of the war. But it's probably one of our most important wars. I mean, 20 years after the Constitution was passed, we were about to disassemble.
All right. Well, listen, I appreciate your time here today, and happy travels wherever you decide to go for your summer vacation. And we'll be in touch, Dennis Byrne. Thanks again.
Thank you, Mike. Pleasure right. to be there.
You bet. See you now. Right back, WGN. All right. Looking at the history of the playoff here. We're trying to get a hold of this guy, and I guess he's at work and not answering, but he had a playoff lawn going. Lives in Park Ridge. And I guess he was, you know, back when we had all the flooding and all that, he was busy with other things, let the lawn go. At the same time, the Hawks were winning, and he decided just to call it his playoff lawn. And he said, I think it was on Channel 2, he said that it got up higher than his knee, like halfway up his thigh. And he got a notice from the city saying that, you know, you have to cut your grass. It's, they say, a breeding ground for mosquitoes or something like that. Well, he never opened it. And one night he's watching the Blackhawks, he hears a mower, and the city came and mowed his lawn. And so he started growing it again. And he had a sign on the lawn that called it a playoff lawn. So people would know. And he said people drove by, and they would honk, and they'd appreciate it, and they'd wave, enjoy his playoff lawn. So it's getting higher now. Doesn't look like it's quite a foot high, but his plan is to let it go again. So, and of course we have the playoff beard. People grow the beards. There's one or two of them here in the building. And I was thinking about it, and I can't think of any, I'm not claiming any superiority here, because I wish I had a superstition that worked. I don't think I have one where something I do brings a team luck. You know, I used to at one point, the one thing that used to happen was, and this lived in Cincinnati, this is way back when like Dave Parker was playing, I noticed that they would hit a home run when I was in the men's room. So if they needed one badly, whether I had to use it or not, I go to the men's room, and a couple of times they hit a home run while I was in the bed.
So you would go to the men's room with the hopes of missing a home run from your home team.
Missing a home run because it was, in the long run, it was better off.
Right.
They're down two with 2-1 and Dave Parker at the plate. I got to go to the bathroom.
So that's whole new meaning to the idea of taking one for the team.
Precisely.
Right.
Whether I took one or not. I might just go in and wash my hands or stand around.
Uh-huh.
And because it had happened, you know, a few times in a row where you could, you know, the radio's on in the men's room. And I know it's maybe I did it 5 times and it worked twice. So that was my only superstition. But, you know, I don't know if anybody else carries a superstition with them.
You have a way of bringing on rain delays at Wrigley Field.
Yes, I do.
Yeah.
And we'll see what happens today. At one point, we were 5 for 6. If it wasn't a rain delay, I still, you know, I was here in the event there was a rain
close
delay.
Close enough to cover.
Right. 5 out of 6 in a row, because if it goes to a rain delay, then it comes back to me until 3 o'clock. So, yeah, 5 out of 6 times. And today.
And sometimes, right, don't you do the noon show anyway?
I did it once by accident. One of the first rain delays of the year, I was sitting in the office. And it started about a month ago, I don't know, and Alex Quigley came in and said something to the effect of, well, they're, you know, we're going to take it back, so I can go on if you want. And I said, no, I'm here, I can do it. And I did, and I was on the air for about 10 or 15 minutes, and I realized it wasn't even my show. I wonder why he asked that in the first place.
Once again, taking one for the team.
You got it.
Right.
I just give and give and give, I really do. But the history of the playoff beard goes back to the 80s and the Islanders, which we'll get to. But maybe you have a playoff superstition you'd care to share or a sports-related superstition. Hey, Amy, what's going on?
My husband, we have 4 boys, and when our twins were in high school, they're the middle two. When they started, my husband decided at the beginning of the football season he would not cut his hair until the end because he was convinced that my 2 sons were on a winning team. They won state every year he did that. My sons have 3 state championship rings from those years.
Really?
And then when they played baseball, he decided, I'm going to not cut my hair, and they won state both times.
So did he make it a point to start with his hair real short at game one?
He would buzz his head and then let it go, and it would get to shoulder length.
And that was fine in his work environment, I guess.
It was totally fine. And now, unfortunately, it has not worked for our son's college football team. But we're hopeful.
Well, what school were they at? Where were they when they won three state?
They were at Burlington Catholic Central in Burlington, Wisconsin.
How about that? How about that?
Yeah. Tiny little school.
Well, good for them.
Yep.
All right, Amy, I appreciate that, and why don't you enjoy the playoffs? How about that?
Thank you.
All right, take care. See you later. Right back following news. This is WGN. What I went to see last week was Second City Explains the Opera, which was pretty funny. And probably the more you know about opera, the funnier it is, but you don't have to know anything about opera to get it. And it's really interestingly done. It's at Lyric Opera, but it's all done on the audience is on the stage. So it's a very deep stage, and it's 300 or 400 people, I guess. And you're facing out toward where the audience would be, the theater itself, Lyric Opera. So that's the backdrop behind this smaller curtain. So I mean, it's a beautiful room, obviously. And it's a funny show, too, so I'd recommend that. Second City Explains the Opera. Check it out for yourself. What else? We have our winner already? Jan, it would be. Hey, Jan, how are you?
I'm fine.
Do you want to go to Morton Arboretum and see the CSO?
Oh, that would be wonderful. Thank you.
All right. A pair of tickets coming your way. And again, it's 5 concerts, the 27th through the 30th of June. So you stay
right. Oh, my gosh.
It's going to be huge. Take some pictures. Send them to us.
Thank you.
All right, stay there. We need more information from you, so don't go away. Right there on hold. That's Jan. Jan, our winner. And float of the question as to whether or not you have any sports superstitions, things that seem to work for you. You know, it's funny how those things pop up. You know, your team won 3-4 games, and you realize, wow, that was the 4 games I took the red line. Therefore, I have to take the train every time I go for the team to win. And they come out of nowhere, but it makes no sense to you. You just know it works. And, of course, that was the case with Gary last year, Gary Meyer, his stints whenever he did the show from the UC in the afternoon. What was his streak? I mean, it was incredible because the Hawks weren't putting together a streak like they had this year. And he was like 10 for 10 or 11 for 11 or something. So he had to go to Vancouver and didn't quite pan out there, but still had to go. What do you got there, Hawks fan?
Hi there.
On a superstition?
Hi there.
You.
I thought Jerry was like 20-2 or something like that. But in the way of good karma, when the Stones were in town, the Hawks at the UC, they played a ton of Stones music in between puck drops. And the other night in that second overtime, when just before the end of the game there, they played Jumpin' Jack Flash. I texted my buddy. I said, good Stones karma coming. And there was the goal.
And there it was.
And there it was. It was a gas, gas, gas.
I wonder if they've caught on to that.
I don't know, but that's why I'm calling you.
Well, we'll pass it along. The Stones seem to have a little bit of magic.
Yeah, unfortunately, tonight they're probably going to have that Bruins jersey up there like you had the Hawks jersey, but whatever.
Yeah, yeah. All right, I'll pass it along.
Pass it along, buddy.
We'll see what happens. Thanks. See you later. See you later. Playoff beards. Back to the Islanders, what they're saying. Hall of Famer Dennis Putvin. The Islanders in the 80s played 4 games in 5 nights, so they actually grew the beards because they were, I guess, too busy to shave. They said it just kind of happened. It wasn't planned. The 1980 Islanders included 2 Swedish players. It's also possible that Bjorn Borg's custom of not shaving his beard during Wimbledon, which he had done for several years by that time, was an influence on the start of the practice in hockey. Some players said the beard is both a reminder of team unity and a way to get you thinking about the playoffs from the moment you look in the mirror in the morning. The 09 Red Wings used the slogan, "The Beard is Back," for their 09 Stanley Cup playoffs. Played the Penguins in the Cup final that year, won by Pittsburgh. Most of the players and the owner of the team, Mario Lemieux, all grew beards as well. Then you had the beard-a-thon thing, and then that mustache thing is cropping up across the country. But there's the beginning of it. In other sports, playoff beard in football, Ben Roethlisberger and others go with the beard during the playoffs. Pro bowlers, Matt Light and Logan Mankins grow beards until they're eliminated. Both showed up at the Pro Bowl, much cleaner cut than in previous weeks. Philadelphia Eagles players grew beards during the 08 playoff run. Basketball, it's happened. In soccer, it's happened. Okay, even around the world. It's not just an American thing, Major League Soccer players, the Houston Dynamo, but Sheffield United striker Alan Cork didn't shave during the club's four-month FAA Cup run, where they got to the semifinals and on from there. Playoff beards are happening everywhere. Everywhere. Do you have a superstition that actually pans out? 312-981-7200. Hello, John, what's up?
Oh, I'd like to say that go Hawks, and I love your program. I put a big sign out on my lawn, and it says, Honk for the Hawks, and people love it. But the thing is, I put brooms, two brooms, and I cross them. You know, and no, a lot of people don't get it, but that does mean sweep. It stands for sweep, you know, so they could do it in four. And it seems to work. It worked last time in 10.
Well, I've seen the single broom. I don't know if I've ever seen the cross brooms.
Yeah, I do that. It's and I found out that actually it was Jim Belushi at a game threw a broom out on the ice, so that's where that came from.
What year would that have been?
Oh God, it had to be years ago. Probably what, 95 was when they did the Stanley Cup, when they made it to that and they lost it. But he threw a broom out. That's how that came out with the broom. Because a lot of people are asking me, why do you have brooms in the lawn? I said, that means that they could sweep it in four.
And then how often does someone actually honk?
Oh, they honk all the time. I can't even, my girlfriend told me, oh, no one's going to, before I put the sign in, people were honking.
Yeah.
They do it all the time. But I count, last game was, I got 19 truckers to do it.
Well, congratulations. Keep up the spirit there, John. I have to run.
Oh, I am. We're out here in Hickory Hills. We're going for it.
Got you covered. Thanks so much. See you later. You know, that's something off the subject, but I have an alley behind my house, and some people feel like they have to honk when they get to the sidewalk. If you just drive real slow, you won't hit anybody, because they honk at 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5 o'clock in the morning. Like not realizing all the people in all those buildings around them might be asleep. Superstitions, Brianna, what's up?
All right, so this is really, really weird. My boyfriend and I, like, the first three games we went to this season for the Hawks, we wore red underwear, thinking, you know, we would be bringing them luck. And then they lost, and so now every time since the playoffs have started, especially during the games, we always text each other in the morning, you don't have on red underwear, right? So our superstition is wearing something other than red underwear, and it's worked out pretty well.
Did you say they won the first three times?
No, they lost.
Oh, they lost all three times. Okay.
Yes, all three times they had lost. So we went ahead and, because they didn't have very many losses, so we figured it was a pretty bad sign.
Why don't you just throw out your red underwear?
You know what? Maybe we should try that. Maybe that would be helpful.
Save it for Valentine's Day. Special occasions. Put it away. Don't even look at it.
We'll do that.
All right, Brianna, we all appreciate your efforts. No doubt about that.
All right, thank you.
All right, have a good day. You bet. See you later, and go Hawks. It's WGN. VoloCars.com. Thank you. Speaking of cars, and newer cars, we now have all this... all these hands-free devices you can now use, where through voice command you can, you know, delete emails, you can send an email, you can send a text, whatever you want to do, and it's all hands-free because we all know we were told that talking on that phone is so incredibly dangerous. You're going to kill somebody talking on the phone. Even though every study I ever saw showed it was a very, very minor cause of most accidents. It didn't happen very often. And then some states said, okay, that's so dangerous, you have to go hands-free. And they found out that was no safer than talking on the phone, which wasn't that dangerous in the first place. But we keep looking for things that are more and more dangerous. It turns out that the new voice command gadgets in your car, they say, are even more distracting than talking on the phone. When will we come up with something new to do in a car that's not more distracting than the last thing? AAA did this study, and they say the following. I love this. Speech-to-text systems that enable the driver to send or scroll or delete email and text messages require greater concentration by drivers than other potentially distracting activities, such as talking on the phone, talking to a passenger, listening to a book on tape, or listening to the radio. So now apparently it's considered distracting to talk to a passenger in your car or listen to the radio. Who drives in total silence? Who gets in the car, says no radio, no music, and no talking? Does anyone do that? I mean, on the list of things that we have to worry about, is it really that big of a deal? It says the greater concentration required to perform a task, the more likely a driver is to develop what they now call tunnel vision or inattention blindness. That means the driver stops scanning the roadway or ignores their side and rear view mirrors. Instead, they look straight ahead, but still fail to see what's in front of them, like red lights and pedestrians. Now, I haven't seen that there's any increase in people running red lights or any increase in people running into pedestrians, but they keep telling us how dangerous it is. They said people are seeing what they need to see to drive. I'm sorry, are not seeing what they need to see to drive. That's the scariest part to me, says the CEO of the AAA Foundation for Traffic Safety. Police accident investigative reports are filled with comments like, looked but didn't see. That's what drivers tell them. We used to think they were lying. Now we know it's actually true. Well, not if the number of accidents isn't going up. And they continue to go down. And that's what got me, that ever since cell phones came into existence. I'm not talking about, you know, deaths or injuries, but the number of people who run into each other has consistently gone down every year. You know, if in fact what we're doing is more dangerous than it was before, they should at least be going up a little bit. But they don't. They keep going down. You know, among the most distracted things you can do, when that's the other one, like a misuse of a statistic. They'll say that, like, talking on the phone is distracted driving, and distracted driving causes 25% of accidents or something. Well, they don't tell you what talking on the phone caused. They lump it together with all these other distractions, which include things like looking for road signs and addresses. And so that's a new one. And whatever we invent next that's supposed to make the world safer, it'll turn out somehow makes it more dangerous, even though the number of accidents continues to go down and down and down. I don't get it. Hey, Joe, what do you got? What's going on?
Nothing much. I got distracted last week, ran into somebody in the rear.
In the rear?
Yeah, I messed up my car. Their car was fine because it all started. I seen two hot women crossing the street, so I started talking to them, not paying attention. The guy in front of me stopped, and I rammed him.
Well, we should ban good-looking women on the side of the road.
Yeah, yeah. And the thing is, I didn't tell my wife. I said the guy stopped for some reason. I don't know. I didn't tell her the real truth. So today, she don't know what happened.
Well, she does if she's got a radio.
That was it, my friend.
All right, Joe, thanks very much. Go Hawks. Thanks. See you later. Kevin, what's going on?
Hey, Mike, I just wanted to say a couple things. The first one is to get away from my kids, I get in my car and listen to nothing sometimes. I don't listen to the radio because the voices just pound in my head sometimes, and I need some silence. So the car is like the best place for silence sometimes.
How many kids do you have?
Two, but I take care of my cousin, my son's cousins, and everything like that. Sometimes in the afternoons too, and it just gets too much noise.
Well, you can't be taking that much care of them if you're sitting in the car.
Well, I keep the way. I mean, I get a pretty Honda Fit, and it's pretty silent in there. So
maybe that's why my dad spent time in the bathroom, just getting away from six kids.
Yeah, and the second thing is for the Hawks. I do chores to get them to score. Like chores I haven't got caught up on, I do, and they usually score when I'm doing them.
When you're doing something else. All right. Well, keep a clean place.
Yep.
Got four to go. Thanks and see you. Alex, what's going on?
Yeah, Mike, I used to work for a company. We drove truck and used to drive around for 8 to 10 hours with no radios in the vehicle, and it drove me nuts. If I want silence, it's not going to be while I'm driving.
Was that a company policy or just cheap equipment?
No, just cheap equipment.
10 hours, yeah. Well, did they have air conditioning?
No, they didn't have that either. So, I mean, and manual transmission, so, yeah, it was the bottom of the barrel.
Well, that's when you go out and buy, like, a good old-fashioned transistor radio and pop that sucker on.
Actually, at one point, that's what we all started to do. I had a little radio there, and had a little extra wire all the way outside and bolted it outside the truck to get some reception. And
you got to have something.
Very few stations you could get, but something was better than nothing.
Yeah, if nothing else, I mean, the radio keeps you awake. You know, if you're driving long distance or something and dozing off, whether it's music or talk or whatever, I mean, it keeps you awake. It's far from a distraction. It's actually a benefit, if you ask me. So,
you know, and I'm only 40 years old, and I drive truck, and my wife says, calls me an old man because I listen to so much talk radio. But I think listening to talk radio, I feel like I'm part of a conversation with someone, not sitting by myself for 8 to 10 hours a day.
Yeah, that plus you end up, if you listen to music, you end up hearing the same stuff over and over if you listen long enough. So
exactly. Well, you're doing a great job, Mike.
All right,
thanks,
Alex.
Take care.
You bet. Drive on, drive safely. And Ed, what's up?
Yes, Mike. Nice to talk to you again.
Yes.
I think that we ought to just turn everything on, all the windows down, have recordings of kids screaming, have all the new newfangled things going all at the same time, and just be totally distracted, and what the hell?
No, I think that's a bad idea, Ed, but thanks. Yeah, that came up once when a law was passed, I guess, at the time. It wasn't probably like a Sony Walkman or something was new, where you first started wearing headphones, or could wear headphones and listen to music. And they passed a law that you could not listen or have headphones on when you drove, which, you know, I guess kind of makes some sense. But then I was curious and looked into it. Were there any restrictions on deaf people driving? And the answer was no. So if deaf people can drive, then... Hey, Beth, real quick, what's up?
Hi, this is Beth. I'm actually with AAA, and we obviously were responsible for putting out the study and just wanted to call and see if I could chat a little bit about it.
Well, I'll tell you what, we're kind of bumping up against the end of the show. How about we put you on hold and chat first thing tomorrow morning?
Okay, that sounds good.
All right, stay right there. Kristen will get all the info, and we'll touch base with Carol Roth just ahead, see what she has going on. This is WGN.